tended to leak, while corroded batteries in a flashlight or camera create an inconvenience for consumers. Chemical reactions could prove disastrous for clandestine operations. Not only did the audio system stop working, gas or liquid seepage that discolored areas around the installation could lead to detection, compromising the operation. A water-based system, like the mercury cell, can give off hydrogen or hydrogen and oxygen gas. The hydrogen is the bad actor, explained Lynn. If you get into a mode with gas escaping, leakage of the electrolyte results. This is corrosive and can change the paint color on a wall. We needed to be able to package every cell so it didn't leak liquid or emit gas. Balancing the laws of physics, audio engineering became a game of technological and operational horse trading, often conducted under the urgency of the crisis du jour. The technical trade-offs with operational requirements were seemingly endless. How long does the device need to remain operational? If only for a few hours in a hotel room, commercial D-cells could work, but bugging a foreign embassy's conference room for 5 years required a completely different technology. How large can the device be, including antenna? That answer was never the same, depending on whether the antenna needed to be installed in a less efficient horizontal position as opposed to the preferred vertical configuration to radiate the signal. What is the window of opportunity for the operation? If it must be done in the next 5 days, the tech ops officers had to use whatever equipment was available. Given an operational window of 6 months or a year, however, TSD engineers could redesign or adapt equipment and technology for a specific application. You'd get a call, "Hey, listen, we're doing something. Can you come to a meeting at 3 o'clock? Remembered Parker. So I'd say, "What are we going to talk about? I'll bring the data I have on that." And we'd all show up, sit down, and try to figure it out. Some of the ops people were very well versed, and others wouldn't know an electron from a trumpet. They came in all flavors. But most of them, you wouldn't want any other way. The guys who didn't have the technical knowledge sometimes had a whole lot of tradecraft knowledge they would bring to the party. One of the things I always used to say, there were enough problems to solve, so when somebody presented you with a solution, you left your pride at the door and said, "Thank you." Chapter 14. The Age of Bond Arrives. If you give me a target, I'll get audio in it. OTS Audio Tech, 1970s. The 1970s were heady years for audio techs in the field and scientists in the lab. The demand for audio ops in every part of the world accompanied the introduction of integrated circuit technology. With the new generation of miniaturized components capable of transmitting greater distances for longer durations, audio concealment seemed limited only by the tech's imagination. Installing audio in walls or woodblocks represented a passive concealment operation. The techs, however, also recognized that miniaturization and tiny electronic components offered opportunities to embed audio devices or cameras in hosts that continued functioning as they were designed. The devices were now small enough to implant into electronic concealments such as clocks, calculators, and radios. Expertise that OTS craftsmen applied to dead drops was now put to use in creating audio concealments. Watches and cigarette lighters were candidates for active concealments. With these concealments, the techs hid the spy gear in everyday objects an agent could carry, wear, or use for their intended purposes. Audio devices were concealed inside furniture, books, cans of shaving cream, clothing, and in one case, a construction worker's hard hat. Maids or visitors leaving a gift or exchanging the desk lamp for a modified duplicate could introduce audio bugs into rooms. CIA defector Philip Agee featured on the cover of his autobiography a photograph of the lid of his typewriter case filled with 60 poker chip batteries, alleging they were part of a CIA operation to bug him as he fled around the world. Concealments were a mainstay of the OTS laboratory. On his initial visit to the lab, a newly appointed office director commented on the variety of high-quality woods that were in the inventory. An OTS craftsman pointed to a piece of lumber and asked, "What do you see?" "Cabinet-grade walnut," replied the director, with pride in his knowledge of woods. "No, sir," corrected the concealment specialist. "That is volume in a cellulose wrapping, and we can put anything we choose underneath the wrapping as long as it doesn't exceed the volume. Once the volume of the bug package, consisting of microphone, transmitter, switch receiver, power cells, and antenna, were reduced to 6 cubic inches or less, relatively small blocks of wood could encase all the system's components. The wood block became the workhorse for quick plant audio operations. RF transparent wood could be cut into almost any configuration with hand tools and then screwed, bolted, glued, or wedged into place. Small blocks could be fashioned to blend in with furniture, the molding in an office, or a picture frame by matching wood types, grains, and finishes. For 20 years after the introduction of the SRT-3, each successive SRT model saw either the size of the transmitters decrease or improvements in performance or security. Transmitter models in the mid-1960s also marked the introduction of signal masking systems to defeat audio countermeasures. Without masking, a technical sweep team could inspect a facility with electronic and magnetic equipment that scanned the RF signal spectrum and detected foreign objects to locate, lock onto, and expose the secret audio transmissions. Masking reduced the vulnerability of bugs by making their signal harder to isolate and identify as clandestine transmissions. One masking technique commonly used by both the United States and Soviets buried the transmission in the signal's subcarrier. RF transmissions were designed to broadcast in two parts, much like stereo. The first part, a clear signal resembling white noise, was passed over as benign by someone scanning the radio spectrum. Then, just to the left or to the right on the dial, up or down the spectrum, was the subcarrier with a clandestine message. By tuning to the right frequency and tuning out the white noise, it was possible to hear the covert transmission. In principle, the use of subcarriers worked like hiding a piece of clear glass in a container of water. The glass remains invisible until the water is drained. Other techniques for using subcarriers sent the audio signal along the existing AC power lines, where it was collected and retransmitted to a listening post. Signals could be encrypted, masked, or both. True to the nature of espionage, each technological advance was inevitably met by an effective countermeasure. In time, KGB counterintelligence teams began tuning in on the white noise in search of subcarrier transmissions. OTS responded and advanced the technology to the next level. "Concealing signals was an area I felt very strongly about," said an OTS manager who oversaw the program. "I wanted to come up with new modulation schemes. Every year I wanted at least 4 or 5 brand new ones to hide our transmissions. For a while, we got into a pattern of using certain types of subcarriers almost exclusively, and, unfortunately, the Russians knew what to look for in our offsets. Eventually, these techniques of hiding transmissions came to include a frequency-hopping technique in which short transmission bursts bounced up and down the radio spectrum in no apparent order. Without a receiver coordinated to the changes in transmissions, these frequency hops proved particularly difficult to identify and intercept, since it was nearly impossible for sweep teams to anticipate the signal's pattern. The complexities and opportunities presented by clandestine audio seemed endless. Installing an audio bug always put the techs at personal risk of discovery and arrest when entering, leaving, or working at a target. Building reliable miniature components for covert systems that could withstand extreme environments challenged the best engineering minds. Configuring the system to operate within the available concealment space required mastery of craftsmanship and design, but no matter how sure the tradecraft and skilled the engineering, none of that mattered without access, and some targets were virtually inaccessible. The problem of access led TSD and its partner, the Office of Research and Development, ORD, to experiment with an array of exotic audio surveillance delivery systems. In the early 1960s, Soviet diplomats in one Central American capital city often conferred in their embassy's courtyard on matters they believed were too sensitive to risk discussing in their offices, which they believed were possibly bugged. The courtyard, while surrounded by a security fence, was not walled, and CIA officers observed that one bench seemed to be a favored gathering place for Soviets of particular interest. Adjacent to the bench was a large shade tree. Station officers had no means to gain access to the bench inside the embassy compound, so the DDP turned to TSD to devise a means to bug the conversations that occurred around the bench. The open security fence surrounding the embassy led to the idea of shooting a bullet containing the microphone and transmitter into the tree just above where the diplomats usually conferred. For the concept of the bullet bug to work, TSD would need an audio device small enough to fit into a projectile, a means to clandestinely shoot the package into the tree, and components that would tolerate the velocity and impact necessary to bury a projectile far enough into the tree to escape notice. A TSD engineer took the concept to the president and chief scientist of America's leading hearing aid company, asking that they build a microphone small enough to fit into a .45-caliber bullet and rugged enough to function after hitting a tree. The problem of small size appeared solvable, but nothing in the company's inventory would tolerate the shock. As the technical discussion progressed, problem after problem arose. It seemed apparent the idea had no future, until the president suddenly interjected, "Well, it's a really good challenge. Yes, let's do it." A team of engineers was formed to create a one-of-a-kind microphone with no manufacturing markings or signature. After obtaining a similar commitment from a company specializing in small transmitters, TSD began testing and evaluation. Within 3 months, a 400 megahertz transmitter, battery, and microphone small enough to fit into the projectile, somewhat larger than a .45-caliber bullet, were delivered. Battery life was limited to less than a day due to size limitations. The antenna was a simple wire that trailed behind the projectile after it left the barrel of the gun, but presented a problem since it caused the projectile to wobble in flight and hit the target broadside. Over time, the techs found that by adjusting the antenna length, the projectile would fly true, embed itself at the proper angle, and maintain the audio link to the listening post. A vintage World War I rifle became the test weapon. Its long-rifled barrel enhanced accuracy by building up projectile speed and stabilizing the bullet and antenna before leaving the barrel. Test firings into 3 1-inch plywood targets clamped together were conducted at an abandoned rock quarry near Baltimore, Maryland. Opting for safety, as they were using an old gun and unconventional ammo, the techs mounted the rifle to a table, placed sandbags around it, and attached a cord to the trigger for firing. After a few test shots, when the rifle did not fly apart, the more courageous techs fired it from a shoulder position. Repeated firings determined the correct amount of powder needed to limit the projectile penetration to no more than 2 inches, the maximum depth from which the microphones and transmitter could operate. The techs found it impossible to use a standard silencer on the weapon, so, to quiet the report, they jerry-rigged a 50-gallon steel drum filled with acoustic baffles. Both ends of the drum were cut away, and a center area of free space was created through which the weapon could be sighted. When fired from within the makeshift acoustic chamber, the sharp firing noise was reduced to a bass boom. Because the weapon was still too loud for operational use, and they were without a technical solution, the planners envisioned a scenario in which 2 loud motorcycles would start at precisely the time the weapon was fired, masking the gunshot for anyone who might be within hearing distance. From the first testing, the transmitter and battery components proved both reliable and functional. The microphones required several adjustments, in part because prior to the requirement, magnetic microphones were designed to withstand drop impacts only, a significantly lower stress than a bullet impact. Eventually, the microphones and other components proved consistently durable when the projectile traveled at approximately 500 miles per hour over distances up to 50 yards. The microphones picked up sounds of a portable radio sitting next to the plywood target, and transmitted quality audio up to 250 feet. In the next round of field tests, the audio bullets were fired into live trees to simulate an operational scenario. Once fired into the tree, two people seated nearby carried on a conversation at normal voice levels. Surprisingly, audio quality was poor compared to the plywood tests. Analysis showed no damage to the device, but the live tree wood proved different from plywood. Tree fibers, when hit by the projectiles, formed cones similar to the design of an echo-free anechoic chamber and swallowed up the audio. Additional analysis determined that if the transmitter size was increased, the necessary audio amplification could be attained. This would require, however, a larger bullet, increased firing noise, and a redesign of the weapon itself. The hole in the tree would also become larger and more noticeable. In the end, the DDP judged the value of the potential information insufficient to justify TSD's cost in time and dollars for additional development, and the bullet bug was filed away. While the project did not result in an audio silver bullet to bug the Soviets, technologies for high-reliability miniature microphones did emerge. Based on data obtained from the tests, TSD produced a series of very small microphones that could withstand high impact and high heat stress. This new generation of rugged microphones could endure rough handling, be installed in almost any wet or dry material, and perform at near zero failure rates regardless of where they were buried. Commercially, the research and design effort by the contractor produced shockproof microphones that enabled the size of hearing aids to shrink, along with improving the microphone's performance in varied temperature and high moisture environments. Animals, as well as technology, played starring roles in the quest to prove that any target could be hit. When CIA operatives sought a means to penetrate the private meetings of an Asian head of state, reports reached headquarters that during the target's long strategy sessions with his aides, cats wandered in and out of the meeting area. Feral cats were common to the region and generally ignored. Whether the concept of an acoustic kitty came from a case officer or a tech is lost to memory, but the idea launched a research project that generated unwarranted ridicule and accusations after public disclosure. In fact, absent from the acoustic kitty project were both cruelty and mutated, grotesque creatures from horror movies. From the beginning, the techs recognized that the concept, undertaken jointly between OTS and the Office of Research and Development, fell into the high-risk category. At the time, embedding electronics inside animals or people was not a routine medical procedure. The implant could not affect any of the natural movements of the cat, nor could the cat experience any sense of irritation or the presence of the device, lest it induce rubbing or clawing to dislodge components or disturb performance. The audio system components would include a power source, transmitter, microphone, and antenna. Working with their prime audio equipment contractor, the techs produced a 3/4-inch transmitter for embedding at the base of the cat's skull, where loose skin and flesh provided a natural pocket. Implanting the transmitter proved viable once a device was packaged to withstand the temperature, fluids, chemistry, and humidity of the body. Microphone placement presented a more difficult problem since flesh is a poor conductor. Eventually, the ear canal became the preferred location. An antenna of very fine wire was attached to the transmitter and woven into the cat's long fur. The cat's size permitted only the smallest batteries, a factor that restricted the amount of hours the audio could transmit. Research to determine the performance of the various individual components and the most effective placement areas was conducted first on dummies and then live cats. Documentation of reactions of the cats to the foreign materials and to nerve stimulation refined the research and eventually produced an integrated audio system suitable for dress rehearsal. Agency officials reviewed questions of humane treatment of the animals and the potential negative publicity should the activity become publicly known. After those factors were weighed against the operational value of the project's success, the techs received authorization to go forward. A small crowd stood behind the vet who conducted an hour-long procedure on a full-grown, anesthetized gray-and-white female cat in a clean, brightly lit animal hospital. The TSD chief audio engineer, seeing the first incision and a trace of blood, asked to sit down. No other complications arose, and after the cat awakened, she was put into a recovery area for further testing. Technically, the audio system worked, generating a viable audio signal. However, control of the cat's movements, despite earlier training, proved so inconsistent that the operational utility became questionable. Over the next few weeks, Acoustic Kitty was exercised against various operational scenarios, but the results failed to improve. Acoustic Kitty demonstrated that transmitters could be embedded in animals without damage or discomfort. The experimental animals could be directed to move short distances to target locations and people in a known environment. However, outside the experimental laboratory, Acoustic Kitty had a mind of its own. Eventually, deployment of Acoustic Kitty in a foreign environment over which the handler would have no assured control was judged impractical, and the project was closed. Exotic detours aside, OTS's most productive audio ops followed a disciplined formula. Identify an operational requirement, select a target, survey the target, assemble the right equipment, establish a listening post, make the entry, install the device, test the system, restore any damaged area to original condition, dispose of any evidence of being there, and get out without getting caught. Audio techs improvised when it came to tools, combining an assortment of commercially available hardware store implements with specially fashioned gear made either in the lab or of their own design. In one operation, a tech used standard well drilling equipment, configured to operate horizontally, to drill more than 100 feet from the listening post to the target site on the opposite side of a major thoroughfare. We bugged every room in that building and then brought all the wire leads down to the basement, the tech who led the operation remembered. I surveyed in on where I wanted to enter the basement, then drilled a hole using just the azimuth and elevation data from the post to the target. I came out a foot away from the target hole. The case officer said, "You missed." I said, "Shit, 109 feet underground in a foreign city, I think I did pretty good." And we figured out a way to compensate for the other 12 inches. Some techs excelled at solving problems with their own inventions to meet specific operational needs. Although of little use beyond covert operations, the devices were invaluable for making installations. The nail pusher, or silent hammer, was used for restoration work on baseboards and molding. Essentially, the device was a hollow tube with a plunger-type mechanism to reinsert nails silently without leaving traces of a hammer mark. One innovation that earned its inventor a unique, if dubious, reputation among his fellow techs was a new microphone housing. Techs had long been beleaguered by the challenge of securing a mic into position within the hole drilled to reach the target's wall. Too often, after the tech carefully positioned a microphone in the hole against the pinhole, it slipped slightly away from the tiny air passage before being firmly anchored. If unnoticed at the time, the smallest misalignment produced a degraded sound. The tech's clever solution encased the mics in a sheath of pliable latex that fits snugly into the 3/8-inch diameter hole leading to the pinhole. Because of the phallic appearance, techs named it the Peter mic. As intelligence flowed through audio's reliable equipment, so did the audio tech's confidence in their tradecraft skills. Among the techs, and even case officers, the thinking became, if access could be obtained, almost any target was vulnerable. In some respects, this was spiral development. Hard targets required greater tradecraft skills, and as those skills were acquired, they were applied to even harder targets. The increased sophistication of bugs and a willingness to take on the tough operations required better equipment. For instance, drilling holes represented a core skill for audio techs. Holes for bugs were drilled down from ceilings, up from underneath floors, and horizontally in walls. When the techs could not physically get inside a room to install a bug, they drilled through a common wall. The danger of such an operation lay in the fact that the techs were literally blind to what or who was on the target side of the wall. These drilling operations had two major security risks: noise and unintended breakthrough. Electric drills were fast, but so noisy they were not an option for use in the middle of the night or with the target room occupied. Hand-turned drills were slow and difficult with harder construction materials. To drill quietly usually meant drilling so slowly an installation could require days, especially if multiple bugs were being installed. In a typical operation, techs preferred to start with a 3/8-inch drill bit — the hole had to be large enough for the circumference of the microphone — until reaching the final half-inch of material in the target's wall. At that point, depending on the size of the microphone head, drill bits of less than 0.050 inches were used to drill a breakthrough pinhole. The tiny hole created enough of an air passage for clear audio pickup, while virtually invisible to normal observation. With blind drilling, techs never knew how close they were to the breakthrough point. Even for the best drill tech, it was a matter of guess, estimate, feel, and experience. Wrongly judged, the drill's breakthrough would leave a noticeable hole in the target's wall and debris on the floor. "If we don't know the thickness of the wall, then we don't know for sure when we are close to the other side," explained one tech. "So if we punch through a wall with a 3/8-inch hole, somebody is going to notice. Sometimes when we did inadvertently drill through, we joked that our audio operation became a video operation." Over the years, more than one tech accidentally broke through a wall, then looked into the hole only to see a curious eye peering back. During one operation, a tech drilled a larger-than-intended hole into a Soviet apartment. Several minutes passed. Then, without knocking, the Russian diplomat burst into their room and furiously began berating his neighbors for their carelessness in punching a hole through his wall while hanging pictures. The case officer apologized and assured the diplomat that his workers would be more careful in the future. Targets were not the only ones displeased with tech mistakes. On a seemingly routine operation, the techs made an uneventful entry into a commercial building and began drilling the starter hole into the common wall with a Soviet trade mission. Suddenly, the drill bit broke through, creating a gaping hole in the adjoining room. With no way to repair the damage, the best that the techs could manage was to patch their side of the wall and retreat to the local chief of station's office to report their problem. "We have a nice hole in the wall for audio," the head tech reported. "Good," the COS replied. "Very, very good." "Well, what I mean," explained the tech, "is that we broke through with a really nice big hole." The chief went ballistic. "Get out of my country and never show your face here again." He spoke the order loudly enough that the techs heard each word and didn't even think of putting up an argument. "I guess that tells us something about the lack of sense of humor some of these guys have," whispered one of the team members. A few weeks later, after the chief calmed down, another visiting OTS officer suggested that, given the importance of the target, another attempt was merited. The chief demanded and received assurances a similar mistake would not be made. The installation went off without a problem. Listening to the live audio a few days later, the techs heard sounds of a work crew coming into the room. Not clear from the conversation was whether this was a sweep team or a construction crew, but they were obviously looking carefully at the walls. The techs held their breath, waiting for what would happen next. "Look at this," one guy said. "Damn, what's that hole? That shouldn't be here," came the reply. "Well, we better get rid of it." With relief, the techs listened as the conscientious construction crew repaired the wall with the 3/8-inch hole, never noticing the pinhole a few feet away. This time, even the chief of station was amused. To avoid the disasters of noise or breakthrough, techs would often drill just a few revolutions per minute. To create the pinhole, they would slowly twist a 6-inch cylinder shaft that held the tiny bit with thumb and forefinger, applying little, if any, pressure, and letting the bit pull itself through the final fraction of an inch. The problem of measuring the thickness of the remaining wall between the end of a drill bit and breakthrough was partially solved by one of the OTS's cleverest tools, the backscatter gauge. While the basic technology employed was not new, its covert application was a model of ingenuity. The principle behind backscatter technology is nuclear science. A tiny radioactive source emits a steady